The following podcast is a Super Network production with your hosts, Super Marcy.
It was on regular rotation most weekends. I don't even know how many times I've seen Stand By Me, but it's been many.
The terrible Australian, Be Jermaine.
And he pretty much just yells out, misery's alive, misery's alive. Oh, this whole house is going to be full of romance. Oh, I'm going to go put on some Liberace records. I don't know why that line just killed me for some reason.
It contains coarse and explicit language.
There's some serious going on. And here I'm like, the what is this? Why?
Mature themes.
King himself and also Mick Garris and how they sort of stage how this virus sort of spreads and everything was just very eerie and very unsettling for me.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
For more, please visit supermarcy.com and show your support at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy the show.
G'day everyone, this is Be Jermaine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to the long-awaited episode 33 of the King's Own podcast, the podcast where we dissect the film and TV adaptations of the works of horror author Stephen King. And with me, as always, is my very awesome co-host and the biggest King lover I know, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy. How are you?
Hello, hello. I think maybe King's wife might be the biggest King lover there is, but...
I mean, that is true, but we're talking about reading love rather than romantic or physical love.
Well, I'm one of them that enjoys the works of Stephen King, hence we do this podcast. Yes, we are actually back after a bit of a hiatus, but that just kind of goes hand in hand with what we'll be discussing today.
Indeed, indeed, because it's almost as if this episode, the theme of this episode is things that were meant to come out sooner but took forever to get released.
A little bit.
Yes, but however though, we are joined by a very special guest who is making her return to the show, and that of course is our good friend Amy Dole. Hello Amy, and welcome back to the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me back on board after, I believe, a couple of years. Yeah, I was sitting here with my bottle of holy water and it started glowing and it's like, I am needed to talk about vampires once again.
Indeed, indeed. And that there's a good reason why that is, because today we're going to be talking about the 2024 adaptation of Salem's Lot. And the last time the three of us were on together for this show, we actually talked about both the 1979 and 2004 TV miniseries versions of the book.
Yes, we did. And we figured, oh, yeah, this newer Salem's Lot should be out pretty soon after we did that. And no, it wasn't.
Indeed, indeed. And we'll go into why that is shortly, so we might as well get straight to it and talk about the 2024 Max original film, Salem's Lot.
This town is dying. Because something terrible was born. Something between Hubie Marston and that house. Where's the body?
These people don't die, do they?
I have no idea what you're getting yourself into.
Not just a killer, is he?
No.
Which, of course, was written and directed by Gary Dauberman, based on the novel of the same name by Stephen King. This film stars Lewis Pullman, Mackenzie Lee, Alfre Woodall, John Benjamin Hickey, Bill Camp, Jordan Preston Carter, Nicholas Covetti, Spencer Trait Clark, William Sadler, and Pilu Asbeck, and if I butchered your name, please forgive me, And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb, is an author returns to his hometown of Jerusalem's Lot in search of inspiration for his next book, only to discover that the townspeople are being attacked by a bloodthirsty vampire. This is our third time discussing Salem's Lot for this show. And it has been a while since we last talked about the two miniseries, the 79 version being an absolute classic, the 2004 one, so much. But we all knew that at some point, Salem's Lot was going to come back in a big way. And it was announced in 2019 that a new film version was going to be released that was going to be produced by James Wan and written by Gary Dobberman, who has quite a hand in the horror genre since he has written all the Annabelle films and as well as directed the third film. And he also co-wrote both It Chapter 1 and 2. So it's no stranger to Stephen King, since we have talked about him on this very show. So the film started being made in 2021. And was supposed to be released in theaters 2022. But then all of a sudden, it was taken off the schedule. And Evil Dead Rise, which was originally made as a Max original exclusive film, decided to take its spot and was released in theaters instead. And then the film, Salem's Lot, was actually put on the shelf for 2 years. And we were all a bit worried because this was around the time when Warner Brothers, particularly David Selzer, the devil, was basically getting rid of movies due to tax reasons, the casualties being Batgirl, Coyote versus Acme. So everyone kind of assumed that is Salem's Lot going to be suffering the same fate? But luckily, for some good news for once out of Warner Brothers, Salem's Lot was going to be finally released in 2024 in October in prep for the Halloween season. But it was going to be a Max original exclusive film, or here in Australia, it was shown on Binge. So this is a film that a lot of people have been highly anticipating. Was it going to be as good as the 79 miniseries or as bad as the 2004 miniseries? So with all that history behind the film out of the way, what did we think of the movie version of Salem's Lot? Marcy, tell us your thoughts on the film.
I'll start with this. What doesn't make sense is that they decided to just have it as a Max original. So why did they cut this up so much? It wasn't going theatrical. So why did we not get like a 3-hour version? Because what we have here, which is just under 2 hours, there's a lot of really good stuff there. But the problem is, you know, you're watching something and you can feel it from the beginning that there's a lot cut out of this, and it feels like it just wants to get from A to B to C without any time to just take things in. And because it's cut like that, we lose so much of what makes Stephen King's work great is the characters and the town. And there's no sense of, like, because we haven't had this build up in this film, really, it's so quick. There's no sense of dread in this town. We're not seeing the characters of Straker and Mr. Barlow like taking over. There's none of that. It happens so quickly, and it's disappointing because there was a lot of good stuff that was there, and it feels like a longer version actually would have been really good, because I think they did really well with the casting. But again, part of the problem is we don't get to see character relationships develop, and some characters just appear, disappear, then reappear. And you know, there was definitely more with those characters. And one example that I can think of that really sticks out is you sort of just in passing, almost if you blink and you miss it, you see Straker trying to, I guess you'd call it a seduction of the Anne Norton character, but you barely see it, and it plays such an important part in that third act. It almost comes out of nowhere, and it's a lot of things like that that really bring it down, because I would say it's shot pretty decently. I like the contrast between day and night in the film, and I think it's got a pretty decent atmosphere going for it, and there's a good mood, but it doesn't get time to really simmer that everything gets developed. Everything is just boom, boom, boom happening. Although I do think one of the strongest aspects is the third act, because where everything takes place, it's really done in an interesting way, and I kind of wish we had a bit more of that. But yeah, and it's only that we get this finale set up because they actually included a scene that would make sense for it. But that was just one case. There are a lot of other cases where that wasn't happening. And I will say, speaking of the Shraker character, I don't know what Pilu Asbak, and I'm sorry if I said that wrong, he felt like he was playing this character in a completely different movie, but somehow it worked. And it's even more disappointing that we were probably robbed of extra scenes with this character. I mean, he's no James Mason. That is a memorable and wonderful performance. But whatever he was doing, I was here for it. That's my ramblings of an initial thought.
And Amy, your thoughts on the film version of Salem's Lot?
Well, I'd like to point to a very prophetic line said by Alfred Woodard's character when she says, "This is some shit."
This is some shit.
Where, like Marcy, when I was going in, I'm like, okay, if this isn't going to be good, and I had heard, you know, the mixed reviews going in, it's probably going to be because a lot of stuff was kind of like jettisoned or cut out or just straight up not included for the sake of meeting the runtime. And I don't know if that was implemented like after the fact. I don't know if this was shot as a much longer thing. I don't know if it was a mini series or if it was always intended to be like a theatrical release. So it's like, okay, we're going to make this like 2 hours, like maybe 2:10 or whatever. And so that all those sort of like that spirit of, okay, we got to get to A, B, C, D, like that was just baked into it from the beginning. But like Marcy said, that is one of the biggest issues with the film, if not the biggest issue, because you can tell with the story, and I'm trying my hardest not to keep going, well, Salem's Lot 79 did it this way, and this way was better. As far as like the story goes, it does have that, you know, classic King scenario where it's like the characters are up against these like supernatural threats, like monsters or creatures or something like that, that are reflective of like societal horrors, like the decay, like the vampire is a metaphor for like the decay under the surface of like this quintessential like American town. But you never get that feeling in this movie, which does a lot of tell don't show, where you're just told it's like, oh, they don't like outsiders, or nobody cares about each other here. And meanwhile, it's like you don't really see any examples of that, especially when, you know, you have Lewis Pullman's character driving into town at the very beginning to Gordon Lightfoot sundown. Ha ha ha, we get it, sundown. As you're passing the drive-in that has Dog Day Afternoon, ha ha ha, we got it, you're fucking funny. Where it's like everyone is just, you know, saying hi to each other on the street, and it's like, hi, Mr. Mailman, and dropping the milk off, and going to the drive-thru, and everyone's all together, and you're just told, oh yeah, nobody in this town cares about each other, no one stands up for each other. Like, the only part where you see that, really, is when Mr. Burke, or Matt Burke, is seeing Mark Petrie, see him getting bullied, and he's, like, the only one who stands up and kind of goes out there and goes, all right, split it up, when all the other teachers are just kind of, you know, fucking around smoking. But, again, that really doesn't seem like, oh, this is a symptom of the things that, of, like, the complacency or the evil that this town already has, even before Straker and Barlow show up. It's so you're just really left wanting more of this whole other story that the movie always like is literally telling you is happening, but you don't really see that. And so you have that. And then on the other side, again, as Marcy said, you don't really see Straker and Barlow as this really mounting threat. Like, weirdly enough, they're talked about a lot. You hear even, like, Mark be like, oh, Straker's his assistant. I have to go kill Barlow. It's like, at some point, you're like, how do they freaking know each other's names? It's like, they're just mortal enemies, and they barely ever interact with each other. And so, yeah, there is no sense of Straker, like, kind of setting the townspeople against one another, of kind of exploiting these different things. And there's just the faintest thing of, oh, people think Ben is responsible because he's a newcomer. And that's just because, and that's mostly just feels like, oh, he's dating the secretary at the real estate office, and one guy is jealous. Like, that's just feels like all it amounts to. I know I'm kind of like rambling on just beyond like initial thoughts, but this is what stuck with me. Like, it really, watching Salem's Lot 24 feels like you're disassociating, because you just keep feeling like, wait a minute, did I just blank out and miss some plot? And it's like that for 2 hours.
Yeah, I think you summed that up really, really well.
Well, I guess for my initial thoughts, this was my second time watching the film, because I did watch it when it was released in October last year, and it was one of my bonus films for 31 Days of Horror. Now, I already kind of knew of the kind of the mixed reception that it had, and also the fact that it has a less than 2 hour running time. So I kind of knew what to expect going into it. But I will say, though, I think overall on its own, I think it is still a pretty solid watch. I mean, the both times I watched it, I really enjoyed it. But I will agree with both of you that it really needed to be a lot longer, maybe 3 hours, because I know that the film was always intended for a theatrical release. And Gary Dolberman, the writer and director, has said in interviews that his initial cut for the film was 3 hours long, and there was a lot of scenes that were taken out of the film, including completely different opening for the film, which actually had the character of Ben as a child going to the Marston house and running into the ghost of Marston, who was living there. So that entire sequence was taken out of the film. And it's kind of, watching this film, you kind of knew instantly that it was definitely cut up, because the film begins when we're kind of in, when we're introduced to the character of Straker talking to one of the local townspeople to go pick up a large box that contains something very special inside. Like, as we all know, in the 79 miniseries, that actually happens within the first half hour or so of the story. So this happens right away. So it just throws us right into the story very quickly. So I think if I wasn't already aware of the two previous miniseries and what the plots for those ones were about, I would have been pretty confused going into, like, what is going on? Why are we jumping into, like, say, 20 minutes into a movie? So I could definitely forgive the film for cutting out chunks, because at the end of the day, I feel like this film version is more of a Cliff Notes version of the original story, because it does go from one scene to another, or at least some of the big points of the story. Like, after that sort of initial scene, I think the movie does have a good rhythm for at least the first 30, 40 minutes. But then once Barlow starts going around and turning people into vampires, that's when it sort of starts rushing through its story. But that being said, though, like, did it entertain me as a straightforward vampire film? Oh, for sure, because I think one of the things that makes it work, at least watchable for me, are definitely the cast. I think everyone does a really good job in their roles, and I think a lot of the actors do bring a lot to them, even if they're only on screen for a short amount of time. And also, I think visually the movie looks great. There were so many great shots throughout this film. I particularly love the sequence when Danny and Ralph Glick, the brothers, are walking through the forest and they're being stalked by Straker, but it's all done in kind of like silhouette, and it's just like a blue background, and it just looks beautiful. Like, I really love that shot, but there's also some other great visual motifs and cinematography throughout the film that I just thought was done really well. And I think the movie does have some pretty effective sequences, and also the vampires themselves are actually look really cool as well. Especially, I mean, you can't go wrong with like glowing eyes. And I think how the eyes are done in this film are actually really well done. And there are some creepy moments throughout. And I think the ending is also well done as well, even though I know it's very different from the book or even from the previous adaptations that we have covered, but I actually kind of like the approach that it went for. So overall, it definitely is a mixed bag, and I think it definitely would have benefited from being a much longer film, but it is entertaining and it does have its pluses that definitely, yeah, maybe not as good as the 79 miniseries, but definitely way better than the 2004 miniseries.
I don't think it was much of an effort to be better than the 2004 series, which had the time. It just didn't do it well. And that's this one's problem. There was no time for it. Things happened so bloody fast. It's like, you don't even get to like, it's like the Marsden house just is nothing in this film. Well, is it Marsden or Marsden? Marsden, yeah. So we don't get the house. We don't get much about that house, just that, oh, it sold after such and such a time. And that's such a big plot. It's like this house, why someone moved into this house. We're just missing so much of all that and how this all affects everyone in the town. It's just before you know it, you've got characters dead, they're turning into vampires. And then before you know it, they're at the drive-in to have this final showdown, which again, I think it's a great visual. And I think it's really well done how they do this at the drive-in, something quite different and unexpected. But by the time we're there, it's like, well, are we meant to care about Susan Norton? Because we've barely gotten to know her. We haven't seen this relationship with Ben. And again, how does Mark know everything? And he's so cool and collected after like his parents are murdered. But also, why is he the smartest person in this film?
You know why, Marcy? Because he's a horror fan and horror fans know their shit.
I mean, he knew his shit. But like you said, though, there is like good stuff in there. And that's where I just wanted more. Like, again, the glowing eyes were really effective in some scene. When you have Spencer Treat Clark, who plays Mike, when we know he's been attacked and he's going to turn, and you can see that he is or he has, because of those glowing eyes that you just see very briefly. Like, things like that are really well done. And I think the fact that, like, the Matt Burke character was one of the only characters I really liked, it's because we got something. We knew a little bit about him, and I feel like the film did him quite dirty as well.
Mike? Hey. Mike. You all right? You don't look so good, Mike.
I think I'm sick with something.
How long you been sick?
I'm not sure. I passed out after a funeral. I'm not sure how long I was out.
Danny Glick's funeral?
I can't remember.
You can't remember anything? Even the slightest of details?
I remember eyes.
Whose eyes?
I'll say this, I think Bill Camp is great in this film, and I agree, I thought it was sad that he became a vampire way too quickly, but I will give this film credit, is Matt could have easily had seen the character of Mike and saw those bite marks and kind of shrugged it off, but as soon as he sees him, he's like, oh, he's a fucking vampire.
Well, the conclusion conclusion that this is vampires is so fucking quick.
I mean, I like the fact that it's no nonsense. It's like, you know what? Vampire.
Yeah, like Marcy said, it's really quick that Matt Burke is just revealed as like this expert on vampires, because it's like he goes from, oh, Spencer Tree Clark, you want to come over and stay at my place? You don't look so good. And then just when he begins to suspect it's a vampire, all of a sudden it just cuts to him downstairs. And there's like a picture of like bats or like bat anatomy on the side. It's like, oh, good. You're just telling us now that like, oh, yeah, he's a bat guy. He knows this stuff. Where did this come from? And I hate to say it, it's like earlier I was kind of saying all these bad things. And like, I don't hate this movie. In fact, both of you mentioned some things that, like, I agree were really, really good. Like, overall, the photography was very good. I just, one of the things I liked that this didn't feel like a super romanticized small town where it's like, yeah, at the beginning when Ben Mears is coming into town, like I said, you have all these Americana images of, like, the milkman dropping off the milk and, you know, at the diner and the mechanic and everything and everyone's saying hi. But it doesn't feel like phony. It just it feels like a legit, you know, small town where it's like, okay, yep, everyone kind of knows each other and they're all hanging out at the bar, going down to the drive-in and all that stuff. Also along the photography, that shot in particular of the Glick brothers, you know, walking home, then all of a sudden you just see like Straker come in behind them. It's like, oh, this is really creepy. This is really well put together. As far as the acting goes, for the most part, the acting was pretty much just fine for me. Like, Bill Camp is kind of, I would say he's like the MVP, where he took a role where it's like, okay, not many characters here have a lot of room to breathe, but he was one of the ones where he took it and he's like, I can breathe some life into this. I can insinuate a lot of stuff with my reactions to the things around me. And it's like, he is probably the most deep and interesting character. And Bill Camp was just really good at it. I do have to say, though, Mackenzie Lee's performance, she felt very awkward to me, where it was almost like, I get the feeling she was told, like, okay, play the part where it's like, when you see Ben Mears, you're like kind of weak in the knees for this guy. You're just kind of have a big crush on him. And you're just kind of like, oh, I don't know which end is up. Who? But she just kind of felt like she was drunk a lot of the time, where it's like, okay, like, Ben, what are we doing over here? And it's like, are you okay? It's like, are you medicated? Are you being vampirized now and nobody notices it? And she just felt really loosey-goosey with her performance. Like, she wasn't romantic and like, oh, I really like this guy. It's just, everybody, who's that? It's like, what in the world is happening? But yeah, I don't hate the movie so much as I'm disappointed by what it could have been and what it did give us.
Yeah, I think that actually sums it up, because it is a bit disappointing to know that we probably would have gotten something better and that flowed better, and we probably would have had like a scene with Matt Burke being established as knowing about like the occult and supernatural and stuff. As you mentioned, Bede, like what was meant to be the opening scene with a young Ben would have established like something creepy about this house, but just sort of giving us kind of almost a backstory to this town of Salem's Lot or Jerusalem's Lot. Although I find it kind of, I don't know if it's ironic or not, but we had, if you know much about like the story with Stephen King, there is a short, I guess, prequel story called Jerusalem's Lot, which they did turn into, was that an 8-episode series called Chapel Wait?
Yes.
So they managed to make that, which is a pretty solid show that filled in a lot of blanks in a really good way. But then you've got this, which is like, how can you not tell this story? And
Yeah, one of the critical errors with this movie is like the Marston House, which is cast this pall over the town, like sitting on top of the hill, almost like a gargoyle kind of looking down and firing this fear. One, like you never get that like sense of fear. You can't kind of get the occasional look up there. It's like, oh, it's kind of a spooky old house, I guess. But yeah, Marston House never becomes a character like it was in the Tobe Hooper miniseries. And I think even 2004 miniseries, it still felt like a lot more imposing. It's like, okay, there's some shit going on in this place. And here, just kind of like, oh yeah, I suppose it's kind of a scary house. Meh. And then just move on to the next thing.
Yeah, I feel like we're missing a lot of that because it does have this imposing, like you said, like a gargoyle over the town. And even though it doesn't work, like the 2004 miniseries isn't great, at least you had that. You could establish this town. And I would have liked that, like, even if you had put, like, the drive-in closer to the house for whatever reason, like, you could have tied that in without even trying, but, like, maybe, and that just all got cut out. I don't know. And I don't think we'll get to see, like, a full version of this, which is ridiculous because it went straight to streaming in most territory.
Well, I think the reason why that is, because I would imagine, given we are in the, at the time, where streaming companies are basing a lot of their decisions on algorithms. And I believe I read somewhere that Apple, like there was something about with Apple TV and their original content is like a lot of their films, audiences want shorter things or things that could grab their attention because
this is the thing. If you're going to sit there for 8 hours binging a season of a TV series, you can sit and watch a 3-hour fucking movie. What's the bloody difference?
But right. That's and I agree. Like, it's such a weird...
Do not base things on algorithms! do not need this crap! Anyway.
Yes. Yes, Marcy, we don't.
I was going to say, like, the algorithm can suck my girl dick.
It can fucking suck mine too, anyway.
Well, that's just the, I think, the big major problem that I think a lot of, I guess, streaming services have is they base a lot of their choices when it comes to films on algorithms. And that's why, compared to something like Netflix now, which, you know, when that kind of started becoming a big streaming service, they were bringing a lot of big talent to their service because a lot of big named auteur directors would come and make personal passion projects to them on the service. But now these days, it's pretty much as we see is something like Netflix will just buy a movie or produce a movie, just throw it out there. And I even read somewhere as well, like they even with certain movies to battle people's attention spans, they'll literally have it in the script so that characters actually legit talk about things that had already happened just in case if people have either missed it or if they're doing something else, they don't have to rewind it back because it's already
been established.
That is so cynical and dystopian.
Isn't it? Like if I'm zoning out with something on, I'm putting on something I've seen 1,000 times so I don't have to pay attention. If I'm watching something for the first time or even a rewatch that it's been a while, I'm going to pay attention. But people have very short attention spans. That's the problem.
Yeah, that is a big major problem. And that's why I think it's interesting. Like, I mean, if this film, because as I stated before, it was originally meant to be a theatrically released film, I would imagine that the version that would go out in the theaters would be a 2-hour cut. And then once the film is released on physical media, Gary Dobberman can release his director's cut version.
That's normally what we get. Example, Dr. Sleep, we got a theatrical cut, but that theatrical cut worked really well because it didn't really feel like you were missing too much. And then, of course, when it came out again, they did, you know, the director's cut, like that could have worked for this, but that's the thing. I don't think we're ever going to get it. And it's a shame because I think it would be a much stronger film and there'd be a lot less like plot holes because they would be filled by the missing scenes.
Yeah.
And I agree. Like it's interesting because since the movie has been out on Max Binge here in Australia or whichever other streaming services it has been released. Although I do know it has been released in theaters in some countries, but they just threw the theatrical cut version on the service. But yet there hasn't been any word of a physical media release, which is something, another thing that streaming services have been accused of, and we're sort of living in that age now where pretty much streaming services can easily get rid of films or TV shows. And these ones have not been released on physical media, and they're basically, you could almost consider some of these almost lost films if they get rid of. I mean, look at some of the stuff that was still taken off Disney Plus last year. Even some of the movies they produced themselves were taken off, and they haven't shown up anywhere else unless they have been put on something where you can buy them digitally, but not in terms of physical media. Yeah, unless someone
pirated them, they're pretty much lost, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Sorry, I feel like you cut Amy off as well.
I apologize for that. Go ahead, Amy.
It's okay. I was just kind of going to expand on what Marcy was saying. It's like, if Salem's Lot, you know, a film based on a book by Stephen King, whose works get adapted quite a bit and, you know, have varied box office results, but still, you can sell it on, this is Stephen King. If this movie barely made it out of, like, the tax bracket guillotine that David Zaslav was going through, like, I want to say it took King's intervention to be like, can you just put this fucking movie out, please? If it took a Stephen King adaptation that much struggle just to make it onto streaming, like, imagine the tough time it's going to be to ever get to squeeze a physical media release out of this.
Mm. Yeah, and I don't think there's enough, like, support for the longer version. Like, I don't think we're going to have hashtag, you know, Salem's Lot director's cut by Gary Doberman. So
release the Doberman cut.
Yes, release the Doberman cut.
I'm starting that campaign right after this podcast, just saying. But also too, and it's not even the first time we've seen that even with horror films. And I know we're going completely off track with this movie, listeners, but even something like Barbarian, which even though I know that film was loved, I wasn't the biggest fan of it personally, but that movie was released in theaters. It still hasn't been released on physical media. And that movie actually did really well when it was released. And I'm not talking about like physical media in Australia, not even in the US, it hasn't been released.
That's bizarre.
That is bizarre.
Yeah. And it's one, there's quite a few examples out there, but yeah, it's just a very scary time for movies in terms of like, and you said this before, Barcy, like, a lot of the time with some of these movies, the only way you can really get them if they're taken off streaming services, especially if they're the service's original productions, is you kind of have to go down the pirating rabbit hole to get them or get bootlegs.
I mean, that's why it's important we have something like the Internet Archive. And seriously, fuck you to the people that keep trying to fuck with that. Like, it's our only archive of so many things, and it's important. Like, you should put everything you can on there. We need something. We really do. Like, I don't care if no one's seen a movie for 50 years and no one cares to. It should be available to watch.
Exactly.
Exactly. Good.
Yeah, and I think with this film, it really generates that kind of discussion because it almost was completely lost because they were going to use it as a tax write-off, which makes no fucking sense in the first place. And then to just releasing something that's not even what it was meant to be. Like, I can't remember. I don't know if I dreamed this up or if it was rumored or something, but before all the drama, like, it was maybe going to be split into two, like It Chapter Two was, just to fit everything in. But I don't know how true that was. But for a story like Salem's Lot, to really fit it in and to make it work, yeah, you need the time. But you need the time, and you also need to know what you're doing, which is why the 2004 one didn't really work.
This is more of just like an observation than like any like critical thing. Like, you know, all this talk about this needing more story, this needing more time to let us characters breathe and let the setting really sink in, the themes, let those expand. It's kind of ironic given how, for me at least, the opening credits felt very much like the opening credits of a Netflix series. Because I can see that like popping up at the beginning of like every episode for like maybe like a 6-7 hour like miniseries. Like the blood trail going from Europe and going over to Salem's Lot on the map, and you know, the names of the actors coming up, and it's like, I'm almost surprised it's like that I didn't see different directors' names outside of Gary Dauberman. It's like, oh wow, like SJ Clarkson did this episode or something like that. Like where it just feels like you're being prepped for a limited series type of thing, but it's just like it just a written a movie with a whole lot of stuff yanked out of it.
Yeah, I mean, if this could have been like a 6-episode series. Although now that you mention it with the opening credits, I'm like, you could play the Game of Thrones score over that and it wouldn't feel out of place.
Oh, I think you're gonna go on the same lines as I am, especially since the man of the hour, Mr.
Yes.
Stryker, was in Game of Thrones, and this majestic goofball who comes in and has maybe like 3 minutes in the entirety of a movie. It's like the way I put it is like it's like you're watching Midnight Mass. And a fucking circus ringmaster pops in. He's like, "Oh, for the master, I shall sacrifice you." And it's like, "Who is this clown? Why do I love him so much?"
Why is he so perfect, even though he's acting like he's in a completely different movie?
Greetings, young masters. Are you lost? Would you like a lift to wherever it is you're needed?
No, thank you.
Boys, can I take you home?
Well, that's a thing, Filu aspect. And again, if I have butchered your name, please forgive me. I think he kind of saw what James Mason, and I guess to a lesser extent, Donald Sutherland, did in the previous miniseries. It was like, you know what? I can't top these titans of acting. I'm kind of might have to go in a different direction. And I appreciate the fact that he kind of goes for a little bit more of a Renfield approach to the
It's
character.
like it's Renfield with extra camp, however that's possible.
Yeah, he really plays up the I'm dedicated. He even says like, "Your loyal servant Stryker is here. I have your sacrifice." It's like Renfield played by the guy from The Simpsons who was like, "Yes."
Yes.
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 And he comes across as rather creepy. And when he goes up to the Glick boys and is like, "Do you just need a ride?" And I'm like, and they're like, "We're just gonna go over here now."
Yeah.
And he's freaking out and just staring at them. It's like, "I got nothing else. I'm just gonna look at you boys." It's like, ah.
I mean, I also gotta say, I really, on the second watch, even more so, I really enjoyed Alfre Woodard's performance as Dr. Cody. Like they gender swapped the character in this take of the for this adaptation. And I think it's another case where she definitely brings a lot to the role. I mean, it's Alfre Woodard. She's always amazing in everything. But I love, she just made me laugh quite a number of times. Mainly her reactions.
Because she knew what the fuck she was in.
Oh yeah, she knew exactly, like Filu aspect, she knew exactly what type of movie she was in. And I just had to laugh every time. Like at first, like she is this skeptical doctor about, but she's open to the idea, but she needs proof. And then once the Glick boys' mother becomes a vampire, she's basically, oh hell.
Nope, let me get these tongue to print popsicle sticks. Let's make a cross here, people.
That scene, it's like I'm surprised they didn't cut that scene to bits because she's trying to make the cross with the sticks for like 5 minutes because she's got you need tape.
Use the tape, it has to be bound.
That was one of the freakier parts of the movie when Ben is just trying to keep the Mrs. Glick away from biting Alfre Woodard. She was like yanked around her face, and you just see it, the outline of like, it's like, oh god dang, like it is genuinely freaky.
I know it's quite a well done scene. And the other thing I liked was how just, I don't know, it was the brightness that they had of the crosses or crucifixes when like the vampire was there. I thought it was really cool, like how they how they did that and like when you pick up on when it's glowing so it's working.
Although I had to laugh when Mike goes to attack Mark and he uses the crucifix on him and Mike goes flying back towards the wall. I don't know why that whole visual just made me laugh.
What made me laugh? And I'm like, fucking yes. Again, it's with Mike and Matt Burke is like, I rescind your invitation. And just the way he's like flying out there and just trying to fight it. Stuff like that I like.
My favorite cross scene was when like Father Callahan is up against Kurt Barlow and it's like, I'm a priest, I got faith. And Kurt Barlow's like, bitch, please. And the lit up cross just immediately goes like,
yep.
Like, you just might as well have heard, like, the Price is Right, bum, bum, ba, bum.
Yes!
Well, that's the thing, though. I think at the same time, sort of thinking about this now, I think Gary Dauberman, because based on everything I read, like, Salem's Lot, the book, is his favorite Stephen King book. And I know that he wanted to make this as faithful as an adaptation as possible. And that's why I think, like, I hope one day we see his 3-hour cut, because I imagine that would have been the preferred release he would have released. Mm. But obviously, the studio was like, oh, we need a 2-hour film, so he had to deliver on that. But I think at the same time, though, there are definitely moments in this film where you could definitely tell that he either has a dark sense of humor or he knows exactly what type of story it is. Like, there's one cut in particular. I don't know why this... Yeah, maybe both. But there's one cut in this film that I completely forgot about. And when it happened, I legit was like, what the fuck was that? Was where they're at Danny Glick's funeral and Father Callahan opens up his Bible and then it cuts to Mike opening up his sandwich with the peanut butter in it. I'm like, that is the weirdest transition shot I have ever seen in anything.
A very weird transition shot. It caught me off guard. I'm like, what?
And it's so weird that again, that's a funky shot, but then also in that scene it cuts from him just kind of like having a bottle of pop or and like eating his PB&J while the funeral's going on, and then like he kind of drifts off to sleep, and then it's like the dead of fucking night when he wakes up, nobody came over and nudged him. It's like, hey, can you fill the hole in now, please?
Yeah.
And it's like, they just let him sleep for 7 hours against a fucking tree stump.
They just left him there. Although, when he wakes up, like, when he can hear, like, Danny, that, again, that's another, like, really effective thing. The whole scene, I think, was actually really well done, sorry.
Actually, another scene I think was effective, again, with Mike, is when Mark Burke finds him in the bar and he's just in shadow. And that entire sequence, like Spencer Tracy Clark, he does a really good job with the role of Mike because he brings some, like, you know, there's something off with him, but there's an underlying of creepiness to that character, especially in that scene in particular.
Yeah, he's just like sitting there discombobulated and Burke is trying to be like, hey, what's going on? And Spencer Tracy Clark is like, I don't know what's going on anymore.
it's more of a supporting role. He's not in it much, but when he is in it, he's really freaking good.
Mm. Yeah.
And you pointed this out earlier, Marcy, but I wanted to kind of bring it back to it. I really did like Jordan Preston Carter, who played Mark Petrie. Like, he did a really good job in the role. And I got to say, I got to love his bedroom because he's got so many obscure horror movie posters up on his wall. And maybe this is just me, because in the scene where they kind of replicate the classic Danny coming in through the window scene, I love the fact that in that shot, maybe it's just because I noticed it, is when Danny's at the window, next to the window is a poster of the film Sugar Hill.
Yeah.
Now, that is a zombie film, which I've covered on my podcast, Me vs. Living Dead, which you listen to all podcast streamers everywhere. Ah, had to put that little plug in there. I thought maybe, I don't know if this was intentional, but I would not be shocked if it is, because I know with that film, even though it's a zombie film, the zombies in that film have glowing eyes, or at least reflective eyes. So
that could be a nod, actually.
It could be, but then again, maybe they just like threw it up there. But I don't know. It feels like a weird kind of coincidence, but I thought Carter did a really good job as Mark Petrie. It's probably my favorite take on the character that we have talked about of this adaptation.
He loses his parents. He's just, you know, let's get on with business. He somehow has everything worked out. But I mean, yeah, help with his comic books. I'm sure that came in handy. But how does he know about Barlow and Straker and everything? Like, he puts that together without us knowing much. And I feel like we would have seen that. But I love the scene in that third act where he's like, he gets in a car and he just, I'm going to take down that drive-in screen because we need sunlight still.
And take down the drive-in screen and the shotgun toting new familiar for Barlow that I don't, what was that? Was that who Straker was dancing with in like when?
Yeah, Susan's mum, Anne. And yeah, we like, how are you meant to know that's happening? You can miss that like so easily.
Yeah, I'm just confused because it's that, but then later she's like, oh, Mr. Barlow told me that, you know, I could have you forever if I just watched over him while I was sleeping. It's like, well, how did Barlow talk to you? Because it's almost the insinuation is like they just want us to forget, oh, she was with Straker, so Straker told, but Straker didn't know he was going to get bludgeoned to death by an 11-year-old.
Which apparently, from what I've read, it actually does happen in the book. So Mark does actually kill him in the book.
I can buy this version of Mark doing that.
Yes. Well, that's the thing, though. I think it's interesting because we haven't actually talked about Barlow in...
Because we don't really hear him mentioned all that much, to be fair. He almost just like comes out like, oh, there he is. There's this thing. Like there's so like not the build up to it.
Yeah, like right there at the beginning when you know they drop off the coffin at the Marston house and they leave, it's just you see that quick shot of him just like, all right, I'm here, everybody. It's like, yep, I get the idea. There's really nothing else beyond like except, oh, he can talk.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of the thing we sort of talked about on the last time the three of us got together to talk about the other two miniseries is, like, what approach are they going to do with Barlow in this one? Because the original 1979 version didn't have Barlow talk at all and gave him more of a Nosferatu look, while the 2004 miniseries kind of stuck to how he's portrayed in the book by making him like a normal guy who can speak a lot. So it's obvious, like, I think Dobberman kind of wanted to go for a combination.
Like a mixture? Yeah. Yeah. It feels more like that. But again, I think the look is really good. And what we get, I think, is pretty decent. But we just needed more build up around Barlow as a whole, I think.
Although I did like the scene where you have Ralphie Glick in that bag and he only has that one hole and he can see Barlow coming down the stairs and going. I felt that was pretty well done as a shot. And and also I thought Lewis Pullman was good as Ben Mears. Like, I would say he gives the best take on the character that we've discussed, but I think Lewis Pullman does a pretty solid job of making this likable everyday guy, even though, yes, he's a writer, but then again, this is a Stephen King adaptation.
Like, unless, like, if they didn't have those little establishing things, you wouldn't know he was from this town, he was a writer, he was there to write a book. We get barely anything from Ben, and I really like the casting as well. I thought he really, like, was this character, but we just didn't really get him.
Yeah, it's really weird that it seems like everyone knows, oh, he used to live in this town when he was a boy, but then his parents were in a car accident and he had to go away. But then you have all this other stuff where it's like, oh, they don't like you because you're an outsider. It's like, what fucking which is it? again, it's this thing where it's like, oh, are they playing on like jealousy of like, oh, he actually managed to get away from this town that we're all stuck in and we're all miserable in, but it doesn't feel like they're stuck or miserable. And that's just so frustrating that it never expands on any of this stuff.
Yeah, like, I think it could have been expanded upon a little bit more because we do get hints of that even in the other two miniseries of him being like, even though, yes, he used to live in this town, but the people in the town, once he comes back as an older man, see him as an outsider. It's like, oh, you haven't been here forever. There's something. It's weird that you come back around this time when all these mysterious disappearances are happening. So it's kind of like the townspeople speaking he may have something to do with it. And we do get a bit of that here, but again, it's kind of quickly forgotten about as the story progresses. And I would imagine that would have been explored a little bit more if in that longer version that we've been talking about.
I think we would have gotten more and bits of that stuff and sort of understanding more about the town, I think. But I think we can all agree that this probably needed to be, we needed a longer version because the format exists. It's fine, but you definitely want more from it.
Exactly.
Come on, B, the Doberman cut. Release the Doberman cut.
When we release this episode, we're going to put hashtag release the Doberman cut. Put that in your notes, Marcy.
I'll try to remember.
I guess that could be a wrap for our discussion on the 2024 version of Salem's Lot. Marcy, your final thoughts on the film overall and also your rating out of 5 for it.
Yeah. Again, it gives us something that's good. It's decent. But again, it needed another hour. You need to let Salem's Lot simmer. You can't just rush through it. And that's what this, I guess, cut ultimately amounts to. So it gets 3. You didn't need to make this so quick and fast out of 5, even though it took you forever to release it.
And Amy, your final thoughts and rating out of 5 for the film?
It's as just a straight up, you know, vampire horror film. It's competently made. There's some really good shots in it, some creepy photography, some very good performances. Yeah, there's just too much truncatedness going on around. And even if I hadn't known or seen other adaptations that went into all the things that this movie breezes on by with more detail, I still would have felt like I feel like I'm missing a whole lot. I'm going to go slightly lower than Marcy on this one. I'm going to go 2.5.
I think that's fair.
I'm going to give it about a 3 out of 5. So I'm in agreement with you, Marcy. Like, all the criticisms we have had with this film are very valid. And it pretty much is like the only really big major criticism you could have with the film. It's like it needed to be longer, at least an hour or even a little bit more. So I hope one day we do see this version of the film. But until then, though, for what this film is, I still reckon, despite its problems, I still think it is a pretty enjoyable film. I enjoyed it both times that I watched it. And it's one I could definitely see myself revisited because it is an easy breezy watch and it does entertain you as a viewer. And there's so many other great qualities in it that I think still make it worth a watch. So it may not be as great as it could have been, but for what it is on its own, it's still a pretty decent adaptation overall.
Indeed.
It's a movie.
It's a movie, yes.
It's a movie, exactly.
Well, I guess that could be a wrap for this episode, this long-awaited new episode of the King's Own podcast. Thank you so much, Marcy, for being a very awesome co-host, as per usual.
You're very welcome.
And thank you, Amy, for coming back on to talk about this adaptation with us and also bring some consistency since you were also on the episode when we talked about the 2 miniseries versions as well.
Oh, I gotta stay on brand. Thanks for having me back on.
Exactly. And if they do decide to adapt the story again, we'll make sure to bring you back on for that one as well. Who knows? Maybe we could do a bonus episode if that director's cut version does come out and see how it compares.
I was going to say, have you done Return to Salem's Lot yet?
We haven't, no. But I don't think we've done it mainly because it's not technically a Stephen King adaptation.
But we have discussed doing sequels that aren't based, like sequels to the Stephen King thingies that aren't based on Stephen King. If that makes sense. So that is a possibility.
Indeed.
It'll be a King's Own bonus episode.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. That's the idea, is to do bonus episodes with the sequels. And we'll see if we ever get to Children of the Corn sequels, because there's a lot of them.
5 million of them.
Yes. You could never run out of Children of the Corn sequels. But before we wrap up the show today, Marcy, where can people find you and also this podcast out there on the internet this week?
Yes, you can check out the King Zone podcast as well as the other podcasts on the Super Network. at supermarcy.com. And if you want to give us some support and get early access to episodes, etc., you can sign up to our Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. And you can sign up for as little as $1 a month. And the King Zone podcast is on all the major podcast streaming platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify. So be sure, if you haven't already, to subscribe and like and leave a review and all that cool stuff. And I am Super Marcy on the social medias, probably more so on Blue Sky these days. And I am Super_Marcy on Letterboxd. And you can see some of my Stephen King related lists on there.
Awesome. And Amy, where can people find you on the internet this week?
All right. Recently I signed up for Blue Sky. It's probably where my base of operations, aside from Facebook, is going to be. Just search for Amy Doll, AMIE. And I'll just be posting random stuff, like stuff from my ever-growing She-Hulk collection, as I always, you know, send Marcy here pictures first and be like, look at the crap I got. And she enables me and goes, yeah, look at the crap.
Yeah,
you
it's
got.
The best. It's awesome. I love it.
Well, if people want to find me personally out there on the internet, you can find me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under B. Javide. You can also find all my work over at supermarcy.com, and as well as all the other awesome podcasts that Marcy and I co-host outside of the King Zone podcast. But you can also listen to my solo show, Beat vs. the Living Dead, and as well as this other little podcasts that are also part of its little network on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Beat vs. the Living Dead podcast feed or each show's individual podcast feed. That is a wrap for this long-awaited new episode of the King Zone. Thank you all for tuning in for this one, and we'll be back very soon with another episode. So stay tuned for that, and we'll see you all next time. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
The master thanks you for listening.
Woohoo!
I can see her lying back in her satin dress, in a room where you do what you don't confess. Sundown, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back stairs, sundown, you better take care. If I find you've been creeping round my back stairs. She's been looking like a queen in a sailor's dream, and she don't always say what she really means. Sometimes I think it's a shame when I get feeling better when I'm feeling no pain. Sometimes I think it's a shame.